Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And, you know, Senator Robert Byrd is famous in Washington for keeping a pocket-size edition of the U.S. Constitution in his jacket and pulling it out when he wants to cite chapter and verse during a floor debate. Yeah, it's a prop, but once upon a time he might have been considered a quaint old man for such a thing, but not anymore. And I think the reason that this little book we're giving away, The U.S. Constitution, What It Says, What It Means, a hip pocket guide with a foreword by Caroline Kennedy and an afterword by David Eisenhower, is going so well as a thank you gift in the membership drive, is that this is a day and age where the U.S. Constitution seems closer to our actual lives and more relevant to the day-to-day stories in the news than ever before. The Supreme Court hearings, the warrantless wiretapping controversy, the random subway searches, and so much more. So let's spend a little time with one of the main writers of the interpretive text in this little hip pocket guide, talking about a few select articles of the Constitution, and we can take a few phone calls on the U.S. Constitution itself at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Catherine Colbert is the executive producer of NPR's Justice Talking and a research fellow at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And also with us, we're delighted to have NPR's Margot Adler, correspondent based in New York, as well as the host of NPR's Justice Talking. Hi, Margot, and hello, Catherine Colbert.
Hi there.
Hi, Brian.
Now, I see that this little book comes from the Oxford University Press, but it's also the Annenberg Foundation Trust at Sunnylands with funding, and there's justicelearning.org on here. So are you guys responsible for this in some way?
We are. Brian, this is Catherine here, and we have a whole program that tries to provide education around the Constitution. It includes NPR's Justice Talking, the radio show, but also Justice Learning, the website, and a book series, including this new Hip Pocket Guide.
And why did you decide to do a Hip Pocket Guide to the Constitution?
Well, you know, I was very, very concerned that the level of literacy about the Constitution throughout the country is just abysmally low. We found out, for example, that kids know, more kids can name the Three Stooges than the three branches of government. Mm. We were going to do a show recently on murder, and we figured out that people could probably name nine murderers faster than they can name the nine Supreme Court justices.
I always thought the three branches of government were Moe, Larry, and Curly. So
well, that's probably true, at least the way they're acting these days.
But, well, you know, Brian, we actually did spend some time in Grand Central Terminal asking people just randomly what they knew about the Constitution, what they could, you know, could they name, for example, any of the first 10 amendments, which of course are the Bill of Rights. And what was really shocking, you always hear that, you know, people can't do this, but what's really amazing, except for the lawyers that we talked to, the only amendment that people could name routinely was the Second Amendment. And a few people named the first, you know, freedom of speech. A few people said freedom of religion and mentioned the first again. One or two people could name the Fourth Amendment, you know, about unreasonable search and seizure. But almost no, you know, I would say that 90% of the people questioned couldn't name a single one. And so I think, you know, if you look, what's fabulous about our book is that it is the Constitution, but it's not only the Constitution. In very clear language, there, each section, each article, each section of each article, each amendment is explained. And a lot of little, you know, very often one of the amendments will have, you know, a little sentence that you don't really know about, that you'll know that the Fifth Amendment, for example, has something to do with not, you know, with basically not incriminating yourself, but you won't really know all the details.
That's
and
right.
So what's great about this book is it says a lot about each thing.
And it's got a bit of interpretive text of each one. And you know, I've really enjoyed owning this for the last few weeks, and there's so much food for thought here. Just reading through the text, I went in, Catherine, looking for the obvious things in the news, like privacy or the president's powers as commander-in-chief, but I found myself scribbling notes about things like the general welfare clause of the preamble or the article on treason and the guarantee of the Republican form of government, capital R, I noticed in the text. So we obviously don't have time to do a whole civics course here, but let's look briefly at a few of the articles and amendments that are relevant to the news these days. And at issue in the warrantless wiretapping hearings is the idea of the balance of powers between the three branches of government, Mo, Larry, and Curley. What does the Constitution actually say about the equality of power between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government? Does it go there?
Well, interestingly enough, what we think of as separation of powers and the checks and balances of government are not explicitly written in the Constitution. They're created through the structure that the Constitution sets forth. So, for example, Article 1 sets out the powers of Congress. Article 2 sets out the powers of the president. Article 3, the powers of the court. And it's that interrelationship, the fact that they share some powers and that they have to watch each other on others, outlines that what we now know as separation of powers or checks and balances.
And Margo, remember Samuel Alito in his confirmation hearings took back previous statements of his that said, in his opinion, the executive branch was more equal than the others. He called that inapt when he was asked about it under oath at his confirmation hearings last month. But is it a sign of how the question is not entirely settled just by reading the Constitution?
Well, I think it's fascinating when you look at, for example, Article 2, Section 2, which is the one that's, of course, being used by the Bush administration right now to sort of say that warrantless wiretaps are justified. And actually, when you read that, it becomes very unclear. You know, it basically says the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy. It goes on. It doesn't, you know, it's, you can interpret this in so many different ways. And I think what's fascinating about it is that the Constitution really has a lot of, there's a lot of sway.
The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment.
So it sort of doesn't say much about warrantless wiretaps, does it? That's
right, and that's the entire Article 2, Section 2, and all it says about his relationship to the military is that he's the commander-in-chief. It doesn't really specify what privileges that gives him.
Right, and Brian, I think one of the most important things to remember here is that the Supreme Court, which is established by Article 3, has the power to review the actions of the other branches and to keep them within the powers that are originally set forth by the Constitution. And interestingly enough here, the Supreme Court has ruled in a variety of cases involving the kind of the conflict between executive power and national security and civil liberties. And it is those rulings that I think are really the basis that we're going to have to look at to see whether or not the president acted appropriately.
And let's get to the word warrant itself, which appears in the Fourth Amendment itself. Let me read the Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now,
Catherine, very explicit, huh? The founders were very concerned about the notion of protecting personal privacy and checking government in what they can do.
And interestingly, it's not the right of citizens to be secure in their persons, it's the right of the people. And in many of these amendments, they don't say citizens, they mean people, all kinds of people, including, supposedly, I would imagine, non-citizens.
And it gets back to the Patriot Act debate that's going on, too, because the end of this says, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So when they talk about roving wiretaps, although I think roving wiretaps may well make sense in this day and age when, you know, an individual doesn't just use a stationary telephone, but particularly describing the place to be searched is right in the Constitution.
That's right. And interestingly enough, the question is what's the authority of Congress to say what that means? They passed the FISA Act, which is the Foreign Intelligence Security Act. They thought that they were saying the process that had to be implemented, and the only question that remains is whether or not the president had powers independent of that statute that essentially overrode it.
And what about the word warrant? No warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. Did they think in those days of a warrant as we think of a court warrant today?
I think they did, yes. In fact, the notion of a warrant came from the English common law, and it was a process to ask a court or an independent judicial body to decide whether or not the search was appropriate.
So it's implied that you'd have to get a court warrant before embarking on a search.
Well, it's certainly explicit, I think, in terms of the need for a warrant in certain instances, and certainly the Supreme Court has outlined that. The only question in this instance is not whether or not a warrant was necessary, because FISA certainly said it was. It's whether the war powers and the power as commander-in-chief of the presidency overrides that.
We have a few more minutes with Margot Adler, the host of NPR's Justice Talking, and Catherine Colbert, executive producer of Justice Talking and research fellow at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She also wrote most of the interpretive text to this Hip Pocket Guide to the United States Constitution, which we're also giving away as a thank you gift in our membership drive for a pledge of just $50 or more. I emphasize or more. Here's something I didn't realize until last week. There is only one crime specified by name in the Constitution, and it is?
Oh, let me
treason?
See here.
Treason. Who treason. Said treason?
Treason. Margot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Article 3, Section 3, treason against the United States shall consist only of levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. And so the interpretation here says treason is the only crime specifically defined in the Constitution. Why might that be, Catherine?
Well, I think as a general rule, the framers thought that the definition of crimes is a duty of the states. Remember that one of the big issues among the framers was how to allocate power between state government and federal government. What should the states do? What should the federal government do? Federal government was thought as the limited, the baby here. It had very checked powers. The states did everything else. So treason wanted to be a national crime. And therefore they decided to insert it into the Constitution, but everything else was at least at that point in time considered to be the state's role.
And Margot, it seems to specify treason in order to limit people's susceptibility to that charge. It says treason shall consist only in levying war against the United States. That's
so
pretty
it's not,
interesting.
excuse me. It's not speech, for example.
That's right.
Well, can speech be aid or comfort?
Under Supreme Court rulings, no. Again, speech is protected. You have to take action. And in treason, there's also additional requirements that there be two witnesses, et cetera, that are specified within the Constitution.
Yeah, although interestingly, too, Catherine, your interpretation does say actively helping the enemy by passing along classified information can lead to charges of treason. So some people now say the leaks of classified material about the warrantless wiretaps could be considered treasonous by those government officials who did it. I think that's mostly media hyperbole rather than what lawyers say. But it's interesting that they have words in the Constitution to hook that to and your interpretation in a way seems to back it up.
That's right. I mean, I think the whole notion here of how constitutional protections, for example, the First Amendment and the rights of the press to report on important issues of the day, to keep their sources confidential, are balanced against explicit rights contained in other parts of the Constitution. And frequently, when the Supreme Court is called on to rule in around the Constitution, they have to balance those rights. And we see that balance reflected in just about everything that's going on here, whether it's the balance of national security and privacy, whether it's a balance of racial equality and equality for other people, whether it's, you know, issues, for example, Ten Commandments or Evolution in Schools, Right to Choose Abortion or Gay Marriage. Any of those issues are really questions of how courts balance individual rights versus the rights of government to take action.
And we're just about out of time, but one thing that struck me reading through this is that we constantly think about the amendments to the Constitution, the original 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, and then right up to the 27th Amendment banning congressional pay raises during their term. That seems like common sense. But much of the text here is the seven articles of the Constitution. And, Margo, we seem to be debating that again so much now.
Yes, we certainly are. Again, you know, as far as presidents, what is the power of the president? How much does Congress have power to overrule the president? What is the court's role? All of these things are up for grabs right now, I think, in a way that they haven't been in a long time.
All right. Margo Adler, besides being an NPR correspondent based in the New York Bureau, she is host of NPR's Justice Talking. And Catherine Colbert, executive producer of NPR's Justice Talking, is also a research fellow at the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and behind a lot of the text in this Hip Pocket Guide to the United States Constitution, what it says, what it means. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And again, we're making this book available as a thank you gift for a $50 pledge or more to our winter membership drive, 1-888-376-9692 or WNYC.org.